Hi everyone, welcome to Dharma Threads. This will be our final session and we're going to be discussing the last section of the Samadhippi Sutta, the Discourse on Right View, Majjhima Nikaya number 9. We'll be reading from Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation in the middle-length Discourses of the Buddha. So let's have a look at what the sutta says about choices and the Pali word being sankhara. So we're continuing on with the discussion between Venerable Sariputta and the various bhikkhus here. Saying, good friend, the bhikkhus delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Sariputta's words. Then they asked him a further question. But friend, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma? Venerable Sariputta replied, there might be, friends. When, friends, a noble disciple understands formations, the origin of formations, the cessation of formations, and the way leading to the cessation of formations, in that way he is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma. I should interrupt here and say that this translation we're using of formations for sankhara, I really don't like that. And actually the meaning of it, the literal meaning of sankhara is activities. And so volitional activities here, but even volitional activities is not particularly natural English. Actually the real meaning is something like acts of will or even choices, something like that. Yeah. Anyway, so what are volitional activities? What's the origin of volitional activities? The cessation and the way leading to the cessation of volitional activities. There are these three kinds of sankharas or volitional activities. The bodily sankhara, the verbal sankhara, and the mental sankhara. Bodily, verbal, and mental volitional activities. With the arising of ignorance, there is the arising of these volitional activities. With the cessation of ignorance, there is the cessation of these volitional activities. The way leading to their cessation is just this noble eightfold path. That is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. When a noble disciple has thus understood volitional activities, the origin of volitional activities, the cessation, and the way leading to the cessation, he is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma. He entirely abandons the underlying tendency to lust. He abolishes the underlying tendency to aversion. He extirpates the underlying tendency to the view and conceit I am. And by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, he here and now makes an end of suffering. In that way, there's a right view, his view is straight, has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma. Okay, very good. So, sankharas, huh? Now, sankharas is a crucial term in Buddhist philosophy, okay? And like many terms in Buddhist philosophy, is a bit complex and subtle. And one of the difficulties that we have in conveying about Buddhism is that the terminology that's used is so precise and so carefully used by the Buddha that it's almost like in many ways actually understanding the kind of the nuances of how these terms are used is the key to unlocking the specific meanings of different passages. And if we get that wrong, if we mix that up, then we can very easily end up misinterpreting things. Now, the keys to doing that we usually find are there in the suttas somewhere, but it's not always obvious where they are in suttas, right? So sometimes the key for understanding one particular passage might be found in some other sutta and so on. And so it can be a little bit tricky to try to sort of tease out what is the precise meaning of words in that particular context. But usually it can be done. So in this case of sankharas, I'll just very briefly discuss, first of all, the etymology of the word, the background of it, and then the usage of it in Buddhism. So in terms of the background, the etymology of sankhara is from the root kar, to do. Okay? So to do or to make, to build, to act. So of course one of the most basic verbs that exists in any language. And as such a basic word or such a basic verb, it occurs in any number of forms and any number of contexts. Okay? Sankhara sometimes means something like construction. Okay, so it's a construction of a building. It's also used in a religious context in the pre-Buddhist time to, as a word for the rituals. Okay, so a ritual is also a sankhara. Another thing that a sankhara sometimes means is like a vow or an aspiration. Yeah, that's another meaning that we find. So there's actually quite a lot of other different connotations that we find for the word. So it's one of these terms that has quite a wide spectrum of meaning. And so if we want to use it in a philosophical sense, we have to look at how it's used in that particular context. So if we come to the Buddhist usage of sankhara, we find a number of important meanings for the word sankhara, which are not particularly relevant for this particular case. Okay, so I'll discuss the irrelevant meanings first. Okay, first one, sankhara sometimes means energy. All right? Citta samadhi, sankhara padana samanagatang idipadang is a formula for the idipadas, or basis of psychic power, right? So you have the samadhi produced by consciousness or something like that, different ones, which is padana sankhara, like with active striving. Okay, so it's an emphatic word to emphasize the energy or the activity that's in something. So this is one meaning we find in Buddhism. Another meaning we find in Buddhism is that sankhara sometimes means condition or cause. Okay, so there's a whole bunch of words we find in suttas that are used to mean cause, like paccaya, nidana, and so on. And sankhara we find sometimes in that sense. Sometimes sankhara is also used to mean some kind of process, okay? So, for example, the breath is said to be a kaya sankhara, okay, a bodily activity or bodily process, yeah? So this is another meaning, also not relevant for this particular context. And the last meaning, which is not relevant, but which is a very important one for Buddhist philosophy, is the meaning of something like conditioned phenomena, okay? So actually, that meaning of sankhara's conditioned phenomena is, in many ways, perhaps the best known one in Buddhism generally, and the most commonly used one in Buddhism generally. So we have phrase like, of course, the famous phrase, sabbe sankhara anicca, yeah? Anicca vata sankhara upadavaya dhammino. So all conditions are impermanent, they're subject to rise and cease. For example, in the Mahasuddhasana Sutta, the Buddha talks about the glory and the majesty of one of the great kings of old, Mahasuddhasana. It talks about his palace and his retinue and all of the wealth that he had and the splendor. And he says all of those sankharas are now past. They're all gone. All of those sankharas are impermanent. So in that kind of sense, sankhara means something like the things of the world, you know, worldly phenomena, conditioned phenomena, something like that. And in that sense, of course, it's very broad. Basically, everything is sankharas. Yeah? Everything is conditioned, except for nibbana. Right? So everything except for nibbana is a sankhara in that sense. So like I said, all of those meanings of sankhara are not relevant in this particular context. Okay? So what sankhara means in this place is intention. All right? And so in dependent origination, sankhara specifically means intention, as it does in the context of the five khandhas, of the five aggregates, right? So both in both places, sankhara is defined as intention, right? Now, in the particular context that we have it here, it doesn't actually bring in that definition of sankhara as intention, yeah? It says sankhara is physical, verbal, and mental sankharas, right? And that could be understood in a number of ways. But there are other places also in the context of dependent origination where it specifically makes it very clear that sankhara is intention. And it mentions three kinds of sankhara as intention, which is punyabhi sankhara, apunyabhi sankhara, and anenjabhi sankhara. Okay? And so punyabhi sankhara is the literally meritorious volitional activity. And that, which is another way of saying good deeds, right? And we apunyabhi sankhara, demeritorious volitional activities, again, or bad deeds in actual English, right? As opposed to Buddhist hybrid English. And the last one, anenjabhi sankhara. Yeah? So anenja is a word meaning imperturbable, unshaken, right? Not vibrating, yeah? And it's actually a technical word which is used in Buddhism to denote the states of meditation from the fourth jhana on up. Okay? So a nenja only applies at a very high level of consciousness. So it's those states of meditation and the states of rebirth that result from those, that meditation is called a nenja. The reason why it's called a nenja, because it's characterized by neutral feeling. Right? So you have very strong equanimity. You're not being pulled towards pleasure and pain, right? So that is imperturbable in that sense. So this anenja visankara is the third kind of volitional activity. The question, of course, arises, why isn't that just punya, right? Because if you're talking a very high jhana level of attainments, obviously it's a good thing. Why isn't that described as punya, as merit, yeah? Well, the reason for that is because elsewhere in the suttas and very consistently, the Buddha says that punya leads to sukha, right? So merit, doing good deeds, leads to happiness, yeah? Whereas, of course, anenja is not exactly happiness. It's equanimity. Right? So in one sense, yes, as equanimity, it's even more happy than happy, right? But it's not quite happiness in the same way. So I think that's the reason why anenja visankara is kind of treated separately from punya visankara. But in any case, I think that's more of a technical detail than anything else. The basic point is that there are good and bad choices that we make. Yeah, and we find these kind of constructions used repeatedly in the suttas. It'll say something like abhisanchetayati abhisankaroti. So one makes an act of will and an act of volition. Something like that. So abhisankaroti, right? It's the verb form from sankara, and abhisanchetayati is the verb form from jetana or volition. So one wills and acts, yeah, something like this. So these words actually found throughout the suttas, repeatedly in this kind of context, as very closely linked ideas. Okay, so. Good and bad acts, what's it doing? What's the purpose? What's actually going on here? Well, these acts, these choices we make, create our future. Right? Sankara, in this sense, is very future orientated. Right? We're building up that future, and that future is said to be the fuel and the energy, the force that underlies the sanglatanika vijnana, the on-flowing consciousness. Yeah? Otherwise known as the vijnana sota, the stream of consciousness. Yeah. So the energy that fuels the flowing on of consciousness, both in this life and also through rebirth, yeah, is this sankara. This is what gives us the energies. Yeah. So sometimes those sankaras that we make are quite deliberate. Sometimes you're conscious of it. And there are suttas that talk about this. For example, the Sankara Upapatti Sutta talks about how to get reborn in certain places by making a sankara, right? As if you want to get reborn in a wealthy family, then you make the sankara to be born in that place, yeah? Of course, you have to have the savings in your merit account, so to speak, to be able to get there, right? But if you have those good deeds and so on that you've done, then by making a volition, then it can help to send your mind into that rebirth, or similarly to be born in different heaven realms and so on. So, of course, the Buddha wasn't actually saying you should do this, okay? And it's important to note that, and this is only one sutta really where the Buddha talks about this, but it is possible to make an aspiration and direct your mind if the basis is there. But obviously the point being that really what we should be doing is trying to let go of all sankaras and bring rebirth to an end, right? So that idea of like an aspiration or an act of will, right? But, so we can do it deliberately, of course, but most of the time we don't, right? Most of the time we're not actually aware that's what we're doing. We make choices. And those choices have consequences, right? I mean, we're aware at the time of making a choice, right? We're aware of the fact that we are making a choice, and we're probably aware to some degree of what the ethical quality of that choice is, right? I mean, we may try to justify it to ourselves or try to second guess it or something like that, but generally we have an idea of that. but we don't necessarily do it because we want to create some kind of future conditions. Yeah? Usually we do it thinking that we'll somehow be able to escape the results of those future conditions, right? And if you thought about those future conditions more carefully, you might not make the same choice. Yeah? So we make these sankharas, we make these choices either consciously and deliberately or else unconsciously. Huh? But in either case, the important point about the sankhara is that it has, it's an ethically charged choice. Okay? So it's an ethically meaningful choice, right? So sankhara is not just any old choice, right? Now if you're writing something, if you choose a different font for your article, right? Then of course that's not an ethically meaningful choice, yeah? If you decide I like tea rather than coffee, then this is not an ethically meaningful choice, unless you decide I like tea rather than coffee because it's not made in an exploitative environment and so on, then there might be an ethical meaning to it, right? But normally there isn't. So it doesn't mean that kind of choice, right? That's not the kind of thing which has enough power to really charge your consciousness and to send your mind in a new direction. So the real sankharas, the important ones, are the ones that have some kind of ethical dimension. Yeah? So this is why I asked for everyone to reflect about this a bit before the talk, to think about what kinds of choices have we made, right? Because we make all kinds of different ones. Sometimes we make good ones, sometimes we make bad ones. But if we make good choices, we do them consistently, then that will set up that direction in our mind, which will tend to lead towards happiness, towards letting go of suffering, and ultimately towards being able to let go of all choices. So let's move on to talking about ignorance. Everyone's favorite. Okay, so continuing the conversation, saying, good friend, the bhikkhus delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Sariputta's words. They asked him a further question. But friend, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, whose has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma? There might be, friends. When, friends, a noble disciple understands ignorance, that's avijja, the origin of ignorance, the cessation of ignorance, and the way leading to the cessation of ignorance. In that way, he is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma. And what is ignorance? What is the origin of ignorance? What is the cessation of ignorance? What is the way leading to the cessation of ignorance? Not knowing about suffering. Not knowing about the origin of suffering. Not knowing about the cessation of suffering, and not knowing about the way leading to the cessation of suffering. This is called ignorance. With the arising of the asavas, or the defilements, here translated as taints, but I don't really like that translation, so I'll just use the word defilements instead. With the arising of the defilements, there is the arising of ignorance. With the cessation of the defilements, there is the cessation of ignorance. The way leading to the cessation of ignorance is just this noble eightfold path, that is to say, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. When a noble disciple has thus understood ignorance, the origin of ignorance, the cessation of ignorance, and the way leading to the cessation of ignorance, he entirely abandons the underlying tendency to lust, he abolishes the underlying tendency to aversion, he extirpates the underlying tendency to the view and conceit, I am, and by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, he here and now makes an end of suffering. In that way, too, a noble disciple is one of right view. His view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma. Okay, so very good. So in this case, we've seen in the pattern where in the previous definitions that each term has its own, defined in its own terms, often in terms of the six senses, right? So consciousness and contact and feeling and so on were defined in terms of the six senses. The beginning of the sutta, we started talking about the Four Noble Truths, and here we've come back to the Four Noble Truths, and ignorance is defined specifically as not lack of knowledge about the Four Noble Truths. Now, when talking about the last few factors, I've mentioned that we've struggled to be able to translate them well in English, On the other hand, I think ignorance is a pretty good translation, and it's fairly standard. Everyone seems to use it, and it doesn't seem to cause any problems. Everyone will find some problem somewhere along the line, but basically it seems to be pretty good. The only catch is not really with the word itself, but just understanding what is the scope of ignorance, right? And so ignorance in Buddhism and in the dependent origination and elsewhere in Buddhism specifically refers to lack of knowledge about the Four Noble Truths, okay? So it doesn't mean not knowing the way to the corner shop or not knowing the answers to the tests that someone's given you or these kinds of things, right? So this is something which actually became a kind of a bone of contention within the Buddhist tradition. People started to claim that the Buddha was omniscient, that he would literally know everything, and they began to question, you know, what kind of knowledge does an enlightened being have and this kind of thing. And so the Buddha was very clear and very specific about this. The kind of knowledge and kind of wisdom which he claimed and which he said is relevant for spiritual purposes is knowledge about the Four Noble Truths, which of course is what comes down to is knowledge about how one's own greed and attachments and so on give rise to suffering. So that's the ignorance. Now, when the Buddha talked about, if we use a blanket or a generic term of defilements, okay, and under that category of defilements, he talked about a lot of different kinds of ways. We talk about greed, hatred, and delusion. We talk about the five hindrances. We talk about earlier independent origination. We talk about craving. We've talked about upadana or grasping. We talk about the 10 sanyojanas, the 10 fetters. The 7 anusayas, underlying tendencies, and so on. So all these different ways of looking at the same kind of thing, right? So each way of looking at it analyzes it differently and has a slightly different purpose, yeah? But of all of those ways of looking at these things, the most fundamental, the most basic defilement at the root of the whole of samsara, the whole of dependent origination, is this one, avijja, yeah? Ignorance, yeah? Not knowing, yeah? Blindly we go. The Buddha said that he was talking about this, he used this word, the dark mass of ignorance. Yeah, it's a very kind of evocative phrase. Yeah, we can never kind of fathom sort of how long has it been going on with this dark mass of ignorance. And it's from this ignorance that we make choices, right? In the previous session we talked about sankharas, about how we're making choices. Yeah? And of course one of the great characteristics of choices is that we never really know. Yeah? We make choices. We try our best. We try to be informed. We try to reflect. We try to look at what the consequences of the choices are. But at the end of the day, we actually never know. Yeah? And this is that ignorance, is that avijja. So whatever choices we're making, it'll always be suspect. Yeah? It'll always be corrupted because we never make a choice in full knowledge. Yeah? So, the path to undo dependent origination is the path to undo ignorance. Yeah? So this again, we can trace this back, and it's looked at in different contexts, that the fuel for ignorance is the five hindrances. Yeah? And then, so then that traces back into meditation. Right? And this is where the connection between dependent origination and meditation becomes very strong. Because what are you doing when you meditate? Well, you're expanding your consciousness. Yeah, you're making your knowing brighter. Yeah, you're shining a brighter light in and dispelling the darkness. Yeah, so the more that we practice meditation, the more that we make our mind purified and bright, then the more we are dispelling ignorance. It's a direct consequence of that. Yeah, these are like the flip side. The flip side of the brightness of mind is the dispelling of ignorance. The two ways of looking at it. So it's saying, good friend, the bhikkhus delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Sariputta's words. Then they asked him a further question, but friend, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma? There might be, friends. When, friends, a noble disciple understands the defilements, the origin of the defilements, the cessation of the defilements, and the way leading to the cessation of the defilements, in that way, he is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma. and what are the defilements? What's the origin of the defilements, the cessation of the defilements, and the way leading to the cessation of the defilements? There are these three defilements: the defilement of sensual desire, that's kamasava; the defilement of being or existence is bhavasava; and the defilement of ignorance, avijjasava. With the arising of ignorance, there is the arising of the defilements. With the cessation of ignorance, there is the cessation of the defilements. The way leading to the cessation of the defilements is just this noble eightfold path. That is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. When a noble disciple has thus understood the defilements, the origin of the defilements, the cessation of the defilements, and the way leading to the cessation of the defilements, he entirely abandons the underlying tendency to lust. He abolishes the underlying tendency to aversion. He extirpates the underlying tendency to the view and conceit, I am. And by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, he here and now makes an end of suffering. In that way, too, a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma. That's what the Venerable Sariputta said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Venerable Sariputta's words. Okay, so here, once again, the form and the structure of the passage is similar to what we found previously, but we're introducing this topic of the asavas or the defilements. And here it's there's three kinds of asavas: the sensual desire, being or bhava, and ignorance or avijja. Each one of these is said to be an asava or a defilement. Now, it should be just noted just in passing that in some places in the suttas we also find a fourth asava. So this is one of the ones that's a little bit inconsistent. Sometimes in the suttas we also find a dittasava, an asava of views. Yeah. So we discussed the nature of views and so on previously when talking about, especially in upadana and grasping. So this is, that's a similar in meaning there. So, the question here when talking about the asavas, as we discussed when we're talking about ignorance, the Buddha looked at these defilements, these roots of suffering, the roots of samsara, from multiple different perspectives, okay? And each one has its own purpose. Now, here we have three specific ones being mentioned, yeah? The asava of sensual desire, karma, bhava, existence, and ignorance. So, in a sense, okay, so the karma asava is straightforward enough, right? So it's similar to karma tanha or karma upadana, right? It's about attachment to experiences of sensual pleasure, so that's fairly straightforward. Bhava asava is a bit weirder, isn't it, right? So we have this word asava meaning like a defilement or something like that, and yet we're calling existence a defilement. It's weird, isn't it? Yeah? So the defilement of existence. But what it means here is basically being attached to being reborn, basically is the idea, yeah? So it's like bhava tanha, yeah? The attachment to rebirth. So bhava means we want to continue, yeah? I mean, sometimes bhava is actually translated as continuation, which is actually not a bad translation. Bhava means you want to keep on being. Yeah? So bhavasava, I want to keep on being. And avijjasava is where we're attached to ignorance. Yeah? So this also is one of those asavas. So what is the term here? So a bit of discussion of the terminology is always useful. The word asava is derived from the root to meaning to flow. Okay? So sava is to flow, and the prefix ar typically means coming or coming into something, okay? Although when you're reading or interpreting Pali, you can't read these prefixes, especially you can't read them very literally. Yeah? Sometimes it might mean that, but more often it's an idiomatic usage, so you have to look at it from the context. And it's surprisingly, it's one of these terms which is not entirely clear what the intended metaphor here is, right? It's clearly it's a metaphorical term, but the word asava is actually used in a number of different contexts, and so you'll see some quite different translations of this depending on the context. Sometimes people say the asavas means asava, to flow in, right? And so then you see translations like, say, the influxes, or the influences, right? Influences is perhaps not a bad one actually, influences, yeah, the influence of malign influences, yeah. Not a bad one, but anyway, very literal. But sometimes it's also interpreted as being outflows, right? So it's the opposite. So then you hear outflows or pollutions or something like that. And so that's felt to be, so the influences are things that sort of come in and dirty your mind. The outflows are ways that your mind expresses itself and moves out and flows out into the world. But it's also used in the sense of being like a fermented drink or something that's rotten is also called an asava. Okay, so that you sometimes find fermentations or intoxicants, even corruptions, also used as translations of asava. So all of those have some justification from etymology and usage. But one context, I think, which is often omitted from the Buddhist point of view is that of Jainism. And the word asava is a very common technical term used in Jainism, which is a pre-Buddhist philosophy. And so like many of these terms, they're just sort of common words which are floating around in the community. So different people use them. Of course, they don't necessarily use them exactly the same way, right? So you can't... The fact that it's used in one way in Jainism doesn't mean it must have been used in the same way in Buddhism. But it does help to be informed about how other people in the culture use the term. So in Jainism, the basic idea of Jainism is that there's a thing called a jiva, right, which is a word for a soul. Right? And jiva is like a quasi-physical thing, which almost seems a bit like it's like a crystal. Right? It's almost like it's like a spark of life or a spark of light or something, which is like pure knowing. So it's like a crystal of awareness, something like that. But that pure knowing, which has unobstructed omniscient knowledge of everything that's happening, right, is obscured by the asavas. And the asavas are like pollutions that flow into it and defile that crystal, or defile that jiva. They darken it. Yeah, so there's obscurations, something like that, actually. But there's definitely the idea in Jainism, it's definitely the metaphor is something that flows into something. Yeah, and that's definitely felt there. I think that gives a good kind of sense for, obviously we don't have the same sort of soul theory in Buddhism, but the idea that the asavas and things which darken and cloud your mind, yeah, and stop you from being aware, I think is the main metaphor here. So rather than trying to translate it too literally, I prefer to just translate it as defilement. Perhaps corruption might be okay. But one of the reasons people don't use defilement is because we're very used in Buddhist culture, we translate the word kilesa as defilement, right? Interestingly enough, though, the word kilesa is actually not that commonly used in the suttas. Yeah, I mean, it is found, and it's found in various forms, but asava is much more common. So I think it's okay to just use defilement for asavas. I don't like the taints that Bhikkhu Bodhi uses. Taints, yeah, taint is not dissimilar from that idea of something which darkens it. But taint is like something that's very small, you know, like if you've got a tin of paint and you taint it, you put like a couple of drops of color in it and it makes it a slightly different shade than what it was before, you know. And asavas is something that's much more powerful than that. So I think, I don't quite like that. Anyway, so I think defilements is good. So the idea behind these defilements is that these are like forces clouding the mind, bringing darkness to the mind, right? And so it's fueled by ignorance. It has that desire which is going out for things, the desire to keep on existing, and which is then promoting that round of samsara and that whole process of dependent origination which we've seen unfolding. If there's one thing, and we'll have to wrap up now, we're just about finishing this session, it's our last session, so I think if it's one metaphor or one idea that we're taking home from these sessions, you know, this is, I think, the one to bear in mind, that it's like a map, yeah? It's a map of our journey. So this sutta that we've been reading, we take it up, we study it, we reflect on it, yeah? We've done the discussion, we should be reasonably clear about what our journey is and what's required, yeah? We don't know every detail, right? But we know enough to start on the journey. Yeah? So let's make a start. So thank you so much, everyone, for being with us for this time, for our wonderful panelists. Also, Thank you, all the viewers and people who've been watching us. And thank you so much also to our wonderful crew who've been helping us put together this program, especially Damit, Deepika and Radha, and all of the others who've made it possible for us to put this series together. So it's been a great pleasure and a privilege for all of us to be able to bring you Dhamma Threads. And we hope that you're also able to understand these teachings, to put them into practice and to realize those fruits that the Buddha was explaining very clearly.